And thank you, everyone, for coming to the Baseball and the Media Research Committee meeting here at Sabre 48, during which we'll be hosting our annual media panel. I'm Chuck Hildebrand. I'm chair of the committee. And we'll get right to the media panel in just a couple of minutes after we very briefly review our committee business. We were launched in March of 2013. That's a little over 5 years ago. I'm chair, and veteran Sabre committee leader John McMurray is vice chair. We're up to 222 members now. That's a lift of 2 points from this time last year. So you committee members already know what we are, but for those of you who are not members and who are new to the concept of the media committee, our mission is to provide research about the media's coverage of baseball as news, which is the story of baseball journalism, its history, its impact on our culture, and the writers who have worked it, and baseball as an event, which is the story of in-game coverage, its evolution, stylistic changes, and the broadcasters who have worked it. Among our available resources is our website, sabremedia.org, where we have over 150 published posts, and we are accepting from anyone who wants to submit a piece on topics related to baseball media. And we have several databases available to people working on research that has a media component, or to people who are just curious. They include our radio station affiliates of all teams since 2013, and we're eager to expand beyond that. Network TV broadcasts, which is a comprehensive database maintained heroically by committee member Tony Miller. Local flagships and announcers for all teams throughout baseball history, or broadcast history, 1921 to the present. And historical baseball writers for most seasons since 1910. They are all available for download through both Microsoft OneDrive and Google Drive. And now to the main event, which is our media panel. And I want to introduce the man who is going to be moderating the panel. He has been called by USA Today the voice of authority on baseball broadcasting. Among his 17 books is the classic Voices of the Game, which became a Smithsonian Institution series and ESPN TV documentary. His just-released book, The Presidents and the Pastime, The History of Baseball and the White House, has been named by the Christian Science Monitor the best baseball book for mid-season 2018 reading, and just in time, because it's now mid-season. Most aptly for today, he went to school at Allegheny College, which is just 83 miles to the north of here, and he spent most of his days listening to Bob Prince chime How Sweet It Is. Ladies and gentlemen, Kurt Smith.
Well, thank you very much, Chuck, and can you hear me? Thank you very much, Chuck, and Bob Prince, of course, also said, you can kiss it goodbye. He said that of any Pirates home run, and as anyone can attest from walking down any street in this area, from any radio, from any front porch, in this entire area on almost any day in any year from 1948 through 1975. Let's talk about that and years since then. Pirate broadcasting, Major League broadcasting, with the Pirates broadcasters themselves. Our first guest was born and raised in Rochester, New York, a city not far from where I was raised. He attended Ithaca College, aired the 1974-75 Charleston Charlies, arrived here in 1976, and aired the Bucs a team record 33 straight years. In 2000, he retired from the booth to teach at Waynesburg University, a finalist that very year, for the Hall of Fame Ford C. Frick Award for Broadcast Excellence. To use his phrase then and now, there was no doubt about it. He's here, Lanny Fertari. Our next guest grew up in Michigan, graduated Michigan State, and learned play-by-play in the minors before saying au revoir to the Montreal Expos during their last 2 years. In 2012, he joined the Milwaukee Brewers, a city where he met his wife, who's from Pittsburgh. After 4 years with the Brewers, he moved to Pittsburgh to call the Bucks. The most recent Pirates voice, he's here as well, Joe Block. Oh my goodness. As Maude used to say on that CBS television show, God will get me for that. And he will. Our next guest, to raise the Jolly Roger. Born in Washington, D.C., raised in Mechanicsburg, he grew up to be a Pirates intern before joining their front office. In 1989, he began play-by-play for Bucks AAA Buffalo, worked for the Empire Sports Network. In 1994, came to Pittsburgh for Balls and Strikes, and in 2009 became the Pirates' voice. Clear the deck, cannonball is coming for Greg Brown. For our final guest, raised in Falls Village, Connecticut, a typical day as a kid was to raise and use a ruler to make a scorecard on a legal tablet, hoping that in a minute his Cleveland Indians would beat the Yankees, then turn on the radio to hear of another Yankees win. In 1964 and 66 to 74, he usually helped the Buccos win, a 103 and 76 record in 10 years, plus two victories in the 1971 historic World Series, including that 2-1 victory in Game 7 that no one here, if he were alive or she were alive, will ever forget. In the 1980s, he joined Pirates Radio and TV. In his 33rd straight year of broadcasting, we salute him as well, Mr. Steve Lass. Now, this is going to be so very difficult because we have so much to talk about and so little time in which to talk about it. We've got about 45 to 47 minutes now to talk about a great variety of issues before we open it up to another part of the program, and that is your questions and their responses. So let's begin. And let's begin with Lanny Fitari. Lanny, your Pirates road began at the ripe age of 20. And it began with two legends. It's 1974, and you're a student at Ithaca College, and you're about to join the Charleston Charlies, and you overnight at the Pittsburgh home of Mr. Steve Blass. That's one household name, and it parlays to another. Briefly tell us how one led to another, and 2 years, 33 stay as a Pirates institution yourself.
First of all, let me say good morning to all of you, and congratulate Joe Block, Greg Brown, John Wehner, Bob Walk, and Steve Blass for the great work they continue to do as Pirate broadcasters, and also pay tribute to the gentleman to my right, who I believe is the most influential of all Pirate employees, considering all of that he's done for the Pittsburgh Pirates, and he is the core, the essence of what we often talk about as the Pittsburgh Pirate family. Steve Blass deserves a great deal of credit for all he's done for the Pittsburgh Pirates and for Pirate fans. By the way, 47 minutes. That's not enough time for me to talk about my two ex-wives. 1974, I was in Charleston, West Virginia. And you know that Steve, late in his career, had some control trouble. So the Pirates sent Steve down to Charleston, and we became great friends. And at one point, Steve said to me, would you mind if, when I get knocked out in the second inning, if I came up to the broadcast booth?
True story.
And so we checked with Steve Deminer, who was the manager then, great third baseman, one of the great third basemen in Rochester Red Wings history. Steve said, okay. So every time, every fifth day when Steve would pitch, he'd come up to me and say, I'll see you in the second inning, and he would. Pirates had a great, great PR director, not only great because he was a great PR director, because he was also one of the most wonderful people you've ever met in your life, Bill Guilfoyle. And when the Pirates came down to Charleston that year, Bill said, hey, why don't you, he knew I was going back to Rochester, you go through from Charleston to Rochester, you go through Pittsburgh. He said, why don't you stop and visit with the Gunner and Nellie King? And I did. I told Steve about it, and Steve said, hey, if you're going to come through Pittsburgh, stay with Karen and me. So I got to Pittsburgh this one night, met Bob Prince and Nellie King. Bob Prince put me on the air that night, went home with Steve Blass. I still remember the pizza place we stopped to get pizza for that evening. Next morning, I wake up about 8:30, 9 o'clock. Steve has decided to asphalt his driveway. Now, what are you going to do? Here you are, a young 26-year-old, staying at the home of a World Series star. He's blacktopping his driveway. You have to help him.
That's right.
And what is really painful was back then, he has the clothes for asphalting his driveway. I don't. But we got it done. And let the record show that he has never reciprocated and asphalted my driveway.
And he never got charged for the room.
Great point. I hadn't thought about that.
And that, of course, led to Bob Prince, and Prince allowing him to call an inning of play-by-play. And the next year, you eclipse about 50 other, if I recall, possible candidates to replace or at least succeed Bob Prince. And then you spend the next 33 years with the Buccos. Joe Block, Kurt Gowdy once said that broadcasting in the minor leagues was the absolute best training to become a major league announcer because of what you learn. You learn play-by-play. You learn how to cut and do commercials. You learn how to sell tickets. You learn the business side of the game. If you've worked for three minor league clubs, was the cowboy behind the mic correct?
Yeah, I wish it was only three. it's actually five. One, two, three, four, five teams, I think.
Who's counting?
Over 9 years, yeah. I mean, but it was a proving ground, I think. And, you know, worked in affiliated ball and independent baseball. I worked in short season ball, full season ball, and all four corners of the country, too. I think that's, right on, because the journey is as good as the destination, to use another cliche with that. But I think that really does fit here because, for me, you know, in my 20s, I didn't have to do any asphalting whatsoever, but I did have to I had to do a lot of painting of people's houses or, you know, other things to try to make ends meet along the way. But I think, first of all, it built personally just character for me in preparation to be a husband and a father later in life, but also to be a major league broadcaster because, yeah, you have to do all those things. You have to do them in front of an audience much smaller than this. Night in and night out, and I think, you know, to cut your teeth and make your mistakes there, it emboldens you to be able to try new things or, try to let your personality come out just be bad for a while because it takes, unless you're very, very talented. I've had to work at this. I don't have much talent, so I had to try to continue to get better and better. So I think that's the part of the minor leagues that really helped me, I think Kurt Gowdy was right on with that, is just to continue to work and have a lot of fun along the way. I used to know every pilot and Waffle House in the Southeast. I could tell you, what the best jerky was. There's a place in Waycross, Georgia that you can really get good jerky, for instance, half off on Tuesdays. Not sure if that's still the case anymore, but I really do believe that. I think that's... that's right on, and I was glad for the experience, and I'm glad to be here, of course, now, too.
Yeah. Well, the Waffle
House. Couple more dollars.
Waffle House has a great, well-balanced meal, and I can tell you.
Cheese eggs.
Yeah.
Raisin toast.
Hey.
$3.10.
Here's to the low-maintenance life. Steve Blass, at 9, you wrote a profound essay, and here it is. The smell of a baseball glove. Perfume is wonderful. A new car smells great, but ain't nothing like the smell of a Rawlings XTG 34 pitcher's glove. Pros perhaps less in common with E.E. Cummings than with the late actor Bob Cummings. But, and Bob Cummings was a great actor in my book, but You still have that pitcher's glove, or at least a facsimile thereof, don't you?
It's actually over at the History Center right now. But it still smells the same. No, new cars are great, perfume's great, but that leather is pretty neat stuff.
Well, someone asked you, in relation to that, how do you hold a baseball? And you had a wonderful answer. Can you give that answer to us now?
Yeah, somebody asked me, grips and how you hold a baseball, and I said, I don't know, that's a pretty lengthy subject, but the real truth is that baseball's had a hold on me. I haven't had a hold on the baseball, and that started when I was 8 years old. It has never gone away. It's still a joy to watch it. I've had the pleasure of living my dream with baseball, continue to live it. There are some rough moments, and one of them happened yesterday at the Giant Eagle grocery store out in the South Hills. I went in there, and you go in, you're in the produce department, and this lady came up to me and said, "The Pirates stink, and it's your fault." And I said, "Lady, I'm just here for the eggplant. Leave me alone." That's all. So in spite of those kind of things, it's still an absolute joy to be around this game and watch these guys. And, yeah, the struggles and all that, the high points, the low points, it's still – the greatest game in the world. And I've also had the great fortune, and I will mention it here, and this is just not lip service, but when I got started doing what I'm doing now, I had no clue. I mean, no clue. And sitting in with Bob Prince for a little bit on the cable games, which was an experience in itself, the second game we did, he called down to the press room, and you're not allowed ever to have alcohol in the broadcast booth, and he said, "Send up two screwdrivers." I thought something was loose in the booth he was going to tighten. So it went on from there. But having the chance to work with him and Lanny and Greg, they have been absolutely kind helping me out. And I couldn't have started in a better environment. The cable games with Mike Lang were an experience, too, that I enjoyed with the doctor. But over 20 years with Lanny, over 20 years with Greg, they let me get in quickly and get out and make a comment, but they have made it so easy for me, absolutely so easy, and I will never forget their encouragement and help.
Well, that lady is attributing to you a monumental importance, is she not? Hey. Yeah.
Well, yeah. Yeah. When times are good, you don't mind going to the grocery store.
Otherwise, you have a takeout. Greg, you've worked for years within the Bucs family. The promotions, you're a starring, monumental role as the Pirates' parrot. The sales, the broadcasting, the PR, now the play-by-play. Huh?
I'm hearing some people giggle.
Well, I mean, they haven't forgotten. So the point of the matter is you did it all from within. Talk, if you can, for just a moment about the pluses and the minuses of your approach, which is basically to work your way up, as opposed to someone who might come from the outside. What are the pluses and minuses?
Well, the biggest plus for me is that I can honestly, when I speak to mainly young people who want to get involved in the business, to tell them that it takes a lot of hard work, and I can say that with great sincerity, that I feel like I worked my tail off to get here. Literally cleaning toilets and jock straps down in the Instructional League in Florida in 1979 after my internship got done. In fact, some people, Kurt, believe that because my name was Brown, is Brown, still is, as you know, Steve, that when I started in the organization, Joe L. Brown, of course, the longtime general manager of the Pirates, many thought that I got the job because I was Joe Brown's son. So I clarified that, and by working my way up, I think it did me more good than maybe anybody else. But I'm going to jump on Steve's theme and talk about a couple people that have helped me. And, of course, love having Joe alongside us now because he's become a good friend and he's just a great human being, which I think is so important. I've always felt like, for me, and it's personal with who you like as a broadcaster, but for me, as I grew up, I enjoyed listening to broadcasters who enjoyed being in the booth with each other. I grew up in central Pennsylvania, so it was hard for me to get KDK radio on clear nights, though I would certainly try. And as much as I'd like to say I grew up on the Gunner, actually, Lanny Fratteri was my guy. He was my voice. And from Philadelphia, it was Harry Callis and Richie Ashburn. And those guys were buddies, and you could tell that. I knew it. And then, kind of a surreal experience, got to know them and find out for sure that was not a facade. They were really buddies. And so I really feel that that's important, that you get along with each other on the air. It makes it for an easier, more enjoyable broadcast, certainly for us and for the listener. But Lanny Fritteri, I will not forget. It was like yesterday. I was probably 15 years old. I used to make an annual trip to Three River Stadium to see the Pirates play. My dad was in the coal business and would bring me on annual trips and would hang outside Gate A at Three River Stadium. As you know, Joe Vogel certainly knows baseball. Joe, he was always there reminding us of whose birthday it was today, and he'd throw the baseball to us. But when Lanny Fritteri came out of that stadium, you know, Willie Stargell idolized him, Dave Parker, Omar Moreno, but my knees were shaking. I was quivering as I asked him for his autograph, and he couldn't have been kinder. And then fast forward, and talk about an out-of-body experience to have gotten to know him and learn the business under him for parts of 10 years, and for him to give me the advice, which, going back to your question, Kurt, was the best thing you can do for yourself to learn the broadcast business is to go to the minor leagues. I really thought high of myself. I thought that after spending 10 years around Lanny and Rook and Steve, that I didn't need any experience. I could broadcast a Major League Baseball game, but he insisted that I go to the minor leagues. I did that and spent the 5 years in Buffalo and tried to learn the trade. And then, again, fast forward to have listened to Pirates Baseball and hear all about Steve Blass and his heroics, and then get to know him and sit in the booth with who I consider one of my very best friends on the face of the earth is, again, it's a surreal experience.
Okay, we're going to have, using the baseball signature, around the horn, we're going to have the first of a couple around the horns here, where each of our four worthies up here is going to be asked rapid fire a couple to give their response to a question. So here's the question. Give us your favorite Pittsburgh baseball player and personality. It can be the same person, okay? If the same person is your favorite player and personality, that's fine, but it could be two different people. And Greg, because that last answer was so moving and profound, we're going to start with you.
You won round one, Greg.
We're going to start.
You're saying a player as a fan or a broadcaster? Because no, those are also two different things.
No, your favorite baseball, your favorite Pittsburgh baseball player and personality. I'll start.
Start, Kurt. Yeah. What the heck are you doing, Kurt? You start.
I'll start to avoid.
Don't make
any
it easier. We'll figure this
okay?
out.
My favorite baseball player. Obviously. That would poison the well. Roberto Clemente. Okay. My favorite baseball personality was Bob Prince. Okay. Now your turn.
That's hard to follow. My favorite baseball player, I'd have to say probably Willie Stargell. And my favorite, aside from Steve Blass, my favorite Pirate personality would probably be, I got closest to maybe Al Martin. I don't know if you remember that name, Al Martin, a Pirate outfielder.
Now Steve's turn.
My favorite baseball player, Pittsburgh Pirate baseball, was Bill Mazeroski. Clemente, great. Stargell, great. All those great players. But Maz, I think, was the essence of this city. I think he was a Pittsburgh Pirate, understated, never blew his own horn, gave me great life lessons, told me when I came up as a rookie, he said, all right, you're here in the big leagues now, no excuses. People want to know why you did. They don't care why you didn't. And those kind of things. So Maz really stands out as I think... Well, he is my favorite. He's my all-time favorite. A lot of people to choose from. My favorite Pittsburgh personality is Joe Block.
Really?
Yeah. And in 2 years, what an impact.
No. I was going to say you. I really was. So
I know
now
that.
You've stolen
I know that.
My, you've stolen my thunder.
Yeah, yeah. Here's the $2.
Yeah.
There are so many Pittsburgh personalities. You know, you go to guys like Joey Diven and guys
Joey
out in
Diven.
Yeah, Joey Diven was one of the greatest street fighters in the United States of America.
Pitt football players, right?
Pardon?
He would just... Anybody,
yeah, yeah.
Bring, I love this. Story.
Yeah, two or three. But anyway, I'd have to go through that list. But Maz was so special for me and remains so special for me.
Well, I was going to say you is my favorite personality.
I know that.
I know. You know.
You're only
you
Joe, you're
things?
Only human.
You know these things ahead of time. Obviously, working with Steve, you know, telling stories and just and having laughs and cracking jokes and the stuff that we talk about off the air is way better even. But... On the air is great.
Yeah, so please hold the line there, please.
That's it. But my favorite Pittsburgh player growing up was Teak, Kent Tekulve, because now I grew up in Michigan, so I wasn't a big Pirate fan, but I was always a big fan of his because, first of all, his physique. I was always very slender, still am, just like your last name, still brown. I'm still slender, thank goodness, but not as tall and certainly not as talented, but I played a lot of wiffle ball, you know, backyard and street, things like that. So I would try to throw kind of like Teak and try to make the ball move and things like that. And then I actually saved up probably about 8 or 9 years old to try to buy photo grays. I guess they call them transition lenses these days, but the glasses that he had, except they were just regular sunglasses. And I was sold a bill of goods by some local merchant who I will not reveal today. But I'm still mad at Jim. From the Imperial Liquor Store from the corner.
I know Jim.
12 Mile
and
Little Mac in Roseville, Michigan, but not that I'm still upset about that, saving up for 2 months. But yeah, but so Teak was my favorite player. Yep.
I want to throw a third one in. My all-time favorite pirate wife was Christy Drabeck. My favorite player, Kent Tekulve. We met first in 1974, in 75. Not only, just to give you an idea as to how close the Tekulves and the Frataris are, Kent Tekulve's wife, Linda, is godmother for our daughter, Megan, who, by the way, gave birth to her first child yesterday, my third grandchild.
Wow. How about that?
And without a doubt, my favorite personality is Jimmy Leland. If you've never met Jim Leland, you've got to spend time with this man. Everybody should have a friend like Jim Leland. I had the pleasure. He would invite me up to his suite after games. He shared so much information with me. When I got divorced the first time, he said, where are you going to live? I said, I'm going to get an apartment. He said, no, you're going to live in the apartment above our garage. And I did. What a winner that was. I used to do Jim Leland's pregame show, and we got really, really close. But you know what? Jimmy Leland's one of the most, he is the bluntest person in the world. And I walked into his office one day and I said, Jim, you had a meeting today. What did you talk about? He said, Lanny, if I had wanted you to know, I would have invited you.
Okay. Now, see how easy that was? This is not a paid or even unpaid commercial enterprise advertisement, but as Chuck said, there is a new book out titled The President and the Pastime, The History of Baseball in the White House, and it is on sale at the bookstore across the hall, and I will be signing copies of it after we're done today, and if you would be pleased to stop by, that'd be terrific to talk a little baseball. Lanny, you were way ahead of the curve in terms of the relationship between political history, presidential history, and baseball. I remember years ago you being fascinated by presidential history and presidential trivia. We used to talk about it. In fact, you were on my radio program in Rochester to talk about it at one time. And I've got to think that in your new role of teaching at Waynesburg University, that The same trait of teaching plays into this. Franklin Roosevelt talked about how education teaching was the central tenet of his presidency. Would you talk about for just a moment about this whole concept of teaching? Teaching is what you did as a broadcaster, teaching people about baseball. Is this not what you're doing now?
Well, thank you for the opportunity to talk about, just for a moment, about Waynesburg University, which I think is one of the greatest sports broadcasting colleges in America. As a matter of fact, if you see me darting out of here after we finish up, it's because this week, starting on Monday and completing today, we have our sports announcing camp at Waynesburg University. We have 22 high school students that are there learning about play-by-play and sportscasting, and we have our award ceremony coming up at 11:30 this morning. And so Suzanne and I are going to be jumping in the car and driving back to Waynesburg University. And also, as an aside, two of our outstanding students, Jacob Meyer, who writes for a local newspaper, is sitting over here, and Joe Smeltzer, who's currently a student in Waynesburg University. And I challenge you, you ask Joe Smeltzer any question about any World Series, and he will tell you about it. He's a talent. Both these guys, talented guys. John Kennedy once said that knowledge is power, and that is what I strongly believe is my mission at Waynesburg University. To get students away from worrying about GPAs and understand that it's about knowledge. I often tell them as broadcasters that I want you to get good grades. Hopefully they are somewhat reflective of the knowledge that you've gathered. But the realization is when you're a broadcaster, I've been in the business. This is my 50th year in broadcasting. I have never had anybody in broadcasting ask me what my GPA was. So it's about knowledge. And just to add to my love of presidential history, very often when I see uniform numbers, you see 35, you see Sanguian. I see 35 and I see John Kennedy. I see the number 4 and it's James Madison. By the way, because we have this challenge every so often, too frequently at times, rain delays and whether we're going to fill or not, I came up with my all-presidential team. And the stipulation was that it had to be the last name of a president. So Whitey Ford was my pitcher. Gary Carter was my catcher. Reggie Jackson was one of the outfielders. Davey Johnson was my second baseman. And this I really love. John Kennedy was my shortstop. There was a John Kennedy that you probably know this better than I do. There was a John Kennedy that played for the old Washington Senators.
That's right.
And here's the key, ladies and gentlemen. John Kennedy, the shortstop, had the same birth date as John Kennedy, the president.
Wow.
And what was it? May 29th.
May 29th, of course.
The same as my mother. Nobody remembers that.
Not nobody.
She does, and so do I. So does my father, or did. Okay. Very good. Joe, talking history. And we got two classics to talk about now. Thankfully, they're both with us for a long time to come. And you worked and work with two of them, Bob Uecker in Milwaukee and Steve Blass here. What's it like? What was it like working with Bob Uecker in Milwaukee? And what was it like working with Mr. Blass now?
A lot of fun. Fun is the word, fun. Baseball should be fun. And I think... Steve was a little more accomplished in his career than Uke.
Yes, but...
but...
he never hit 400 against Sandy Koufax.
That's right. Yeah, I think, what, Uke's 14 home runs, he homered Gaylord Perry, Koufax. His first hit was off Drysdale, you know, that kind of stuff. So, but working with guys who have played the game the highest level, and you know, I'm fortunate too to work with Bob Walk and John Wehner too in that regard. But you talk about Uke and Steve, the fun, mixing the knowledge and the intellect of the game, but not trying to do so in a way that is talking down to you or anything like that. We're going to have some fun. It's two guys sitting watching a baseball game, like you were saying, Brownie. You know, just two guys enjoying each other, having some fun. Adding some insight, but enjoying baseball for what it is. And I think it, you bring up those two names. I'm sure there are others, but none come to mind right away of two people that I know that enjoy baseball more that I've known personally than those two men. So I think being able to sit next to him, especially earlier here in my career, it's a great influence. Just a reminder too on those nights that, you know, I don't know. Let's say you're down 8-0, you know, after a couple of innings or so. You got to find a way to make the game entertaining, and I don't think there are two better guys that have shown me how to do that than Bob Uecker and Steve Blass.
Well, Steve, I couldn't agree more with what Joe has said about making the game fun. Ronald Reagan once said that if you give someone in a book or in a speech or in a game, his career, let us not forget, began with baseball, began with recreating a game, embellishing a game, reinventing a game with the Chicago Cubs. And he was often behind 8-0 in the 1930s. But he once said that if you give a crowd 15 facts and one story, and the story is told well, it's the story people remember. And few people have told a story as well as you. Now that the pressure's on, can you tell us two stories that you told me before? One is about Mickey Mantle and John Blanchard, and the other is priceless, about what Roberto Clemente and you discussed once in the possible case of you having been traded and you pitching to Clemente.
Well, first of all, I grew up in Connecticut, so the Yankees were very much in my face, although the Cleveland Indians were much better. They didn't win as many games. So I listened to the Yankee games all the time, and the time when the Yankees had Yogi Berra, Elson Howard, and Johnny Blanchard was a third-string catcher, and Blanchard never played. I mean, he had two great catchers in front of him, but he got that World Series ring and the check every year, never got exposed. He lockered next to Mickey Mantle. So Mantle comes into Yankee Stadium one day, and Blanchard's sitting in front of his locker, and he's got tears coming down his eyes. And Mickey said, "John, what's wrong?" He said, "Mick, I just got traded to Kansas City." And Mick says, "That's great. You'll get a chance to play." He said, "Mick, that's why I'm crying. You know I can't play." So now you go fast forward to being a rookie with the Pirates and Roberto Clemente, who we had up on a pedestal, didn't dare talk to him until you felt like you kind of validated your abilities, that you could be a legitimate teammate. And for me, that took a while. So after my second year, I went up to him and said, "Hey, Roberto, here's the deal. If I ever get traded, I'm going to pitch you inside, because every National League pitcher pitches you away 350 every year." He said, "Blass, I'm going to tell you one thing. You pitch me inside, I hit the ball to Harrisburg." Good talk. And I just slunk back over to my locker. The phrasing was a little bit different, but you get the idea. And just real quick, one of my favorite stories involved one time I had to go, and baseball's about stories. I don't know the infield fly rule. I don't know any rules. I don't know any strategy. So thank God for these guys. And Joe has been wonderful, because he's my newest audience. Everybody else has heard almost. But anyway, I went to one All-Star game, and you know, to walk in the clubhouse, it's fabulous. You got the best of the best. You got Seaver over here and Aaron over there and all that, and it's dazzling. My locker was next to Johnny Bench. And back then, it was funny. We didn't fraternize. So I didn't know anything about Johnny Bench, other than he was a tough out, and he hit me very well. So I never knew much of it. So I said, "Hey, John, you know, good to be here with you." And he said, "I understand you're pitching the third inning." And I said, "Yeah, you know, they had them structured that way." And he said, "What kind of signs do you want to use? You know, one's a fat." I said, "Well, John, every time I pitch against you, you seem to know what's coming. So why don't we just wing it?" So that's how I made my living. Five bad jokes and two World Series games. It's been a good run.
This is so instructive.
Instructive.
No, it is. It is instructive as to what appeals to people about baseball. This is just my view. Analytic, schnanalytic. It's story. this is what appeals especially to young people. Not that, you know, it just works. Greg Brown, let's talk about your dad. There is the phrase, a baseball lifer. I had the great fortune to write for someone who, at age 5, this is George H.W. Bush, swung a baseball bat and thought to himself, as he said to me later, baseball has everything. What a wonderfully precise and concise way of saying why he loved the game. He just turned 94 last week. He's still watching the game. He still loves the game. He's still 5 years old at heart. That's 89 years of loving the game. You had a dad who loved the game, and he was a baseball lifer. Can you talk about him?
He grew up in Connellsville, and as I said earlier, he became a lobbyist for the coal industry. We moved to D.C. 68 when things got bad in D.C. I'm one of 7 kids. He wanted his family out of there, moved to Harrisburg, and that's when I started taking the annual trips. In fact, I said to Steve, this place brings back memories. This was the old Hilton at the Triangle. Remember that, for those of you from this area? At Hilton at the Point, and this was my, I called Pittsburgh, Kurt, to me was Oz. When my father, as a young kid, I'm driving in the passenger seat, and he's driving through the squirrel hole tunnels, and all of a sudden, this city opened up with the big buildings, and then I got to stay in this hotel, and he would spend an entire day at meetings, and he had this little kid running around the lobby of the Pittsburgh Hilton. Mr. Seminatore was the bellman, who he, I'm sure, tipped nicely and said, just watch him. And I would run around, get autographs of all the visiting players. And up until about 10 years ago when we moved to a new home, and my wife did a lot of the moving. It was during the summer, and I was rummaging through some of my boxes. I said, hey, where are all, you know, I have autographs of Willie Mays, Hank Aaron, Johnny Bench, Pete Rose, Roberto Clemente. Had them in these albums. Stacked. I said, do you know where the, she goes, oh, that box that was in the corner in the attic? I said, yeah. She said, I threw that away. God love her. God love her. So anyway, but my love of baseball comes from deep roots in Western Pennsylvania. My dad, grandparents, all Pirate fans.
Father and son. The heart of the game. Okay, time for Around the Horn, again, favorite Pittsburgh baseball moment. I'll start with what to me is, I guess, rather obvious. I was at a Cub Scout meeting when this occurred, October 13, 1960. To me, it is not simply the Mount Everest of Pittsburgh moment, but you can make a case that this is the greatest baseball game ever played. I would. Game 7 of the World Series. It took 2 hours and 36 minutes. 22 hits were arrayed. And 10-9, 19 runs. It had everything that you'd want in a baseball game. There was not one strikeout. It was a game of contact. There were a lot of lessons here for the seers of baseball and the barons of baseball as they ponder how to make the game more seductive for the young people of America. It was a great, grand, unbelievably wonderful baseball game, and the right team won. The Pirates, 10-9. Your greatest baseball Pittsburgh moment was?
Well, first of all, I agree with you about the 1960 World Series Game 7. I'll also admit to you that having grown up in Rochester, New York, I went into depression because I was rooting for the Yankees. My favorite all-time Pirate memory is the clincher in 1990, Jim Leland's first division title, spinning off my friendship with Jim. That game, Doug Drabek pitched a masterful game. And the final out, Jose Lean took a ground ball, second base, and they carried Jimmy Leland off the game. That's my all-time favorite. Also, I believe that Major League Baseball announcers are always looking for those moments that, and I also believe that a real good baseball announcer can capsulize in a short period of time the essence of what has just happened. If you hear a baseball announcer go on and on and on and on after a classic moment, that's not the way it's supposed to be, in my opinion. And when Francisco Cordova several years ago pitched 9 no-hit innings, and they had recently changed the rules so that really wasn't a no-hitter yet. And then Ricardo Rincon pitched no-hit baseball in the 10th inning, so it still was not a no-hitter yet. And then Mark Smith hit a 3-run homer in the bottom of the 10th inning of that game. And I said, home run, no-hitter, Pirates win, you got it all.
Yeah, that was great. That was.
Thank you. So that capsulizes it for me.
I would have to say I would like to nominate, I guess, the 13 wild card game. I wasn't here for it, but hearing all the different accounts since then, of course, I was in, my wife and I were in Milwaukee. I was still working for the Brewers. Once the Brewers were out of it, we always became Pirate fans. My wife grew up here, so that was our, you know, secret thing that we weren't allowed to say at the time, that, you know, we go for it. So we had, you can still do this, where you can turn off, I know this is funny, you can turn off the announcers, and you could just listen to the park sound. And so we had the sound bar up, the bass, you know, thumping, you know, so you could really just hear what it was like to be there. So that was us. We were sitting in our living room in Milwaukee watching that game and the Cueto chants, and then watching him drop the ball. And it's just a real memorable experience, because we were really hoping that the Pirates, that was going to be, you know, the year. And she was shaking because, obviously, you know, all those years of not being able to go to the postseason, that was the first time back. So that one sticks out in my mind.
Steve.
Gee whiz, my favorite moment.
Where were you?
We do watch the highlight film before dinner each evening. and then we watch it after dinner. But just going through a whole experience of a whole year of a championship season, when I look at this ring, I don't think about the check. Well, I think a little bit about the check. But I think about those guys I went through that whole thing with, you know, 30 games in spring training, and then you have 162 games in a playoff, and you wind up being the World Series champion. In that moment, when I see the highlight film, and I remember the last out, and just what a release that is. You're so focused and you're so intense. It's just unbelievable. And I'm so proud that game took about 2 hours and 20 minutes. I threw 134 pitches and not one visit to the mound. That was a different world. But to play on a team with 3 Hall of Famers and win a championship, everybody has dreams. Not everybody gets to live them. And I'm still enjoying the ride. But that moment when Bob Robertson caught that ball, I will never forget that for the rest of my life. A very, very, very strong second was when I won the third game and my dad jumped off the dugout roof and came out and got into an interview with Tony Kubek and I. We all have or had fathers, and we all have singular moments. And when that plumber from Falls Village, Connecticut, insisted on jumping 10 feet down on the field to see his kid that just won a World Series game, ain't nothing better.
I think it was September 24th, 2013, Pirates playing the Cubs at Wrigley Field, needing a victory along with a loss by, I think, the Braves to clinch a wild card spot, to clinch postseason berth. I was on TV with John Wehner. Pirates win the game in wild fashion. At the end, there's a play at the plate. Russell Martin tags out the potential tying run, and the Pirates win. And moments later, we learned that the other team lost, so we had clinched. And they wanted us to stay on the air and go back and forth with the clubhouse celebration. Rob King from then Root Sports was doing the interviews, and John and I were seated in the TV booth at Wrigley Field just relishing in this moment, and I had happened to grab a couple of cigars, Lanny, you'll be happy to know, from a downtown cigar store in Chicago, and just had them in my satchel. And I said, what the heck? And I pulled them out, and as they're doing interviews down there, I light them up. John and I start smoking stogies, and Keith Moreland, the color broadcaster for the Chicago Cubs at the time. They all loved the fact that the Pirates finally clinched. Even the Cubs, who had gone 100 years without winning a World Series, felt sorry for us. So Keith Moreland came into the booth as he saw us smoking stogies, and he handed us a bottle of Crown Royal. And a secret only for this room, because I think the Pirates would care for it, but we snuck a couple of Diet Cokes and a little Crown, and we kind of celebrated that night on the air. So that absolutely stands out. And 13 years, rewind 13 years, to October 1st, 2000, John Wehner, I became pretty good friends with because he was a player in Buffalo and played with Bob Walk. And on that day, Gene Lamont, the manager of the Pirates at the time, decided a real touch of class on his part to start a kid who grew up in western Pennsylvania, in Carrick, Pennsylvania, John Wehner, who was a part-time player. I think he hit a total of 4 home runs in his entire 10-year career, and just a real touch of class. I'd never do this, but I decided to get a big scorecard and have each player at his position sign it for me, and I still have it to this day. It's the one memento I have. But I went to John. I sat there at his locker stall, and I said, how cool is this? Would you sign third base John Wehner? He did, and he's just very humble, low-key, self-deprecating humor, and he said, yeah, he said, they're kind of kidding me, too, that they want me to hit a home run. And he kind of chuckled when I said, that'd be great. Ran upstairs to the press box, relayed that story to Bob Walk, who was on radio that night with Lanny. I was on TV that night with Steve and Nellie King. And we chuckled at the idea. How cool is it that John Wehner, our buddy from Carrick, Pennsylvania, is playing in the last game ever at Three River Stadium? 60,000 people going crazy. About the sixth inning, John Lieber, former Pirates pitcher, now with the Cubs. Pirates down a couple of runs, 2 on, 2 outs. Sure shooting. Fastball right down the middle, John Wehner, and it gives me chills every time I think back to it because time stood still for me. I've heard Maz and other players talk about great baseball moments and how Maz was floating on air. Well, when that ball left John Wehner's bat, I stood up and suddenly 60,000 people, it was quiet, and I saw this ball in slow motion heading over the left field wall, and I could not believe it. I kept saying to myself, this is not real. This Carrick kid, this Pittsburgh Pirate fan, is playing for the Pirates last game ever, Three River Stadium. He can't possibly hit a home run. He hit a total of 4 his whole career. Ball leaves the yard, and of course, I go bananas. And I'm just going crazy in disbelief, and I turn around, and who had run up a set of stairs from the radio broadcast booth into the TV booth but Bob Walk? He had left Lanny. And I turned, I saw, and I took my headset off, and I ran back to the back of the booth and jumped in Bob's arms, tears flowing. I felt like Steve Blass jumping into Bob Robertson's arms in 1971. So that was my greatest broadcast thrilling moment of my career.
And there was no Crown Royal delivered in that one.
Well, as a transition, we've got time for just a few questions, a few moments before we have to vacate. Steve, 1971, do you remember when Roberto Clemente spoke in Spanish on TV, interviewed by Bob Prince on national television after the 71 series? What was your thoughts when he did that, when he was talking to his parents?
Well, that was a great moment for Clemente because he'd finally been recognized all around the baseball world like we had seen for 20 years of what his abilities were. And it was a touching moment because he spoke in Spanish before he addressed Bob Prince. It also was one of my most embarrassing moments because after Clemente got through in Spanish, and I couldn't help myself. He's seen me do it. Speak at the wrong time when it didn't need to be said. But to see Clemente just in that moment shine so much. And he tried to convey that. He conveyed to his parents what they meant to him, and then he spoke in English about what had just transpired. But he was just magical in that World Series. I have two memories of plays that did not create outs. Came over to the right field line, kind of did a 360, and threw a strike to Hebner at third base. Nobody, no out there. And then a ball that curled around the warning track down the right field line like a hockey puck going around the boards, picked it up on the warning track and threw a one-hop strike to Manny Sangi, and they held the guy up at third base. But that was just magic. I mean, this is a man who had a presence in the on-deck circle. He had a presence that you didn't want to miss anything he did. You didn't want to take your eyes off him. And to be a teammate for 10 years, that's a gift. But he had his moment, that World Series. And, of course, I finished second in the voting, and the next year I said, I know you got the car for being the MVP. I should have at least gotten the tires. And then he said something in Spanish that I would not repeat in this room.
Lanny, a couple moments here. What memorable stories from the 79, the We Are Family team?
Okay, and by the way, Kurt, I really need to leave after this answer, and I apologize for jumping out of here, but I really do need to get back to Waynesburg. Sure. 1979 was just my fourth year in the major leagues, and it was a magical year if you go back and look at the history of that season. But my all-time favorite game from that game was the Pirates were playing a doubleheader against the San Francisco Giants. It was August 31st of 1979. Doubleheader, first game of the doubleheader. Pirates are leading by one run. Darrell Evans is coming to the plate. Kent Tecovy's on the mound. Chuck Tanner comes out of the dugout, and I said on the air, I can't believe Chuck Tanner's going to take Kent Tecovy out of this game. Chuck took the ball from Kent Tecovy and signaled to the bullpen for Grant Jackson. He wanted Grant Jackson, the left-handed pitcher, to pitch to the left-handed batter, Darrell Evans. On deck was Mike Ivey, a right-handed batter. And so sure enough, Grant Jackson comes in, and then Kent Tecovy starts walking towards left field. And I said on the air, I can't believe that Chuck Tanner's thinking about playing Kent Tecovy in left field. But that was the plan. Chuck hands the ball to Grant Jackson, and he says to Grant, keep the ball away from Darrell Evans. And Grant says to him, are you kidding? Kent Tecovy's on in left field. Chuck says, I don't care. That's what I want you to do. Unfortunately, Grant Jackson missed with the first pitch in. Darrell Evans pulled it outside first, strike one. Second pitch was a breaking ball away. Darrell Evans popped it out to left field. Now think about it, folks. Think about it. What are the odds? What are the odds that Kent Tecovy should be in left field for one batter, and that one batter should hit the ball to left field? And then what are the odds that Kent Tecovy should catch it? And Kent was annoyed after that because, as everybody knows, relief pitchers in baseball are always in the outfield during batting practice catching fly balls. And there were a number of things that went. Remember how Willie Stargell had the stars? And Kent Tecovy was so obsessive about them, he sewed them onto his hat so he wouldn't lose them. So he had stars from Willie Stargell that were a part of the top of the brim of the Cap Anson hat for the wins, and then the second brim was for the saves. And the one star he got from Willie Stargell for playing left field, he put on the top of his cap. And only a few things went on to Cooperstown after the 79 World Series. One of the items was Kent Tecovy's cap. Okay. Thanks for having me here today, folks. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Love you, man.
Okay. Thank you,
bro. One mic. Can I just say one thing, Kurt? Yeah. About one of the greatest broadcasters in the history of Major League Baseball, Lanny Fraterri.
Okay. Okay. Okay, I think we're going to conclude with that. And I want to thank all of our broadcasters, Greg Brown. And incidentally, I want to thank him for reintroducing, if you would, the magic of the abiding phrase, that magnificent raise the Jolly Roger. And clear the deck, cannonballs coming. And would you say, because I have not heard this with any frequency, trip, trip, triple?
Would I say it?
Yes.
Trip, trip, triple. I said, Kurt. I got that from playing wiffle ball as a young kid. One of the kids that played with us, if somebody hit a triple, he'd say trip, trip, triple, and it works because the Rivers Casino is right next door to PNC Park, so it really works.
Ah, yes, the magnificent sobriquets of youth. So thank you very much. Terrific. And, of course, Joe Block, who has brought we didn't get a chance because of time restriction, but he has worked in two magnificent cities, great middle-class work ethic towns, Pittsburgh and Milwaukee, also a wonderful baseball heritage, and he has brought that from Milwaukee to Pittsburgh and has been welcomed with open arms, and he deserves it. A great broadcaster in Joe Block.
And I guess I'm going to add one more thing. I believe it. I believed it when the Pirates hired him. I believe it now. In years to come, down the road, he will be known as one of the great broadcasters in the history of Major League Baseball as well. There's no doubt in my mind. Joe Block. $20, Joe.
The whole wallet.
Thank you.
And there's nothing I can say, need to say about Steve Blass except to say that to call him the face and voice of Pittsburgh baseball is insufficient. He is the soul of Pittsburgh baseball. And earlier I said that he shows what works in baseball in terms of the art of the story and the art of the anecdote. He understands what makes baseball great. He loves the game. He gets it. And you get what matters in him. So Steve Blass, thank you for being with us today. And on a personal note, thank you for inviting me to be with you today. As I said, having gone to college here, it is a great gift to be back with you, and I thank you for that. Thank you very much for being here today.